From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Suzanne Hogan. Sylvia Maria Gross is away this week. On today's show, the Community of Christ Church votes to allow same-sex marriage and gay and lesbian ministers.
We, as Community of Christ, are becoming what our name really means, a community.
Visit a local garden that's recreating a century-old aesthetic. And a new book tries to explain race relations in Kansas City.
There was basically J.C. Nichols in every major city, and they were all friends. And they were the ones who made it part of a realtor's code of ethics nationwide that introducing unfamiliar ethnic group to an all-white neighborhood is, you know, destabilizing.
Plus, a local rapper gets some national love.
A lot of rappers talk that talk, so I smooth watch, giving game out like 50 Iveens inside the dock.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
I'm Suzanne Hogan.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. Whether it's NBA player Jason Collins coming out as gay or another politician explaining his evolving views on sexuality, recent news headlines seem to reveal Americans' rapidly changing attitudes towards sexual orientation. Here in Kansas City, the Community of Christ Church recently added its voice to the chorus of those in favor of equal treatment for gays and lesbians. 2 weeks ago, delegates from across the country came to the church's world headquarters in Independence. They voted to allow same-sex marriage and the ordination of gay and lesbian ministers in its U.S. churches. This week, Alex Smith talked with a leader of the Latter-day Saints Church about the change and some of the backlash it's brought.
In 1830, the Community of Christ broke away from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and they've shifted dramatically in policy from the Mormon Church since. Until 2001, Community of Christ was known as the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Both Latter-day Saints churches hold the Book of Mormon as a sacred text and recognize Joseph Smith Jr. as a prophet. But over the decades, Community of Christ policies have shifted to allow ordination of women and open communion, among other changes. While Smith and the leaders who followed him are recognized as prophets, the church's concept of prophets has also changed over the years. Today, democracy is an important part of the church's policymaking process. Linda Booth, who's one of the church's 12 apostles, explains.
Well, our understanding of our prophetic role has expanded, and we now understand that we're not just a people with a prophet who brings to us divine counsel, but we're also a people that are called to be vulnerable to the Holy Spirit and to one another, and allow ourselves to be prophetic as well.
Linda Booth sits in a meeting room inside the church's towering silver spiral temple in Independence. She describes how the democratic process led the church to what may be its biggest ever policy change. Traditionally, Community of Christ, which has over a quarter of a million members in 61 countries, has not allowed same-sex marriage and required gay and lesbian clergy to be celibate. But at the 2010 World Conference, the delegates of several countries, Australia and Canada in particular, wanted to reconsider that policy. But Linda Booth says not every country was ready for the discussion.
This issue having to do with same gender is very controversial and very harmful to talk about for people who live, for example, in some of the nations where we have Community of Christ in Africa as well, quite honestly, as in Central and South America and Haiti and several countries like that. And so the decision by the body was made that it was best handled culturally in different nations rather than bringing it to the full body to make a decision.
After the World Conference, the U.S. Church decided to start what it called a journey of faith to determine what its own policy should be. At churches throughout the country, leaders spoke with congregants about the issues. And during the recent weekend of April 19th through 21st, representatives returned to Independence to debate and vote on a new policy.
The body of those delegates determined that it was time for us to extend the sacrament of marriage to people in same-gender relationships in states where it's legal, to provide a covenant marriage type ceremony or a covenant ceremony in places where marriage is not legal in states, as well as to provide opportunities for ordination of a person in the long term, such as marriage or covenant relationship, to be ordained.
This policy change will make Community of Christ the first major Latter-day Saints church to allow same-sex marriage and gay or lesbian clergy. Several of the church's doctrinal changes have led to members leaving the church. Since 1980, at least seven groups have left Community of Christ to form their own churches. Linda Booth says the renewed possibility of this kind of fractioning has been a concern during the new policy discussion.
We are being very sensitive to the concerns and the feelings of those people who not only were delegates at the National Conference, but who are home in congregations who are struggling with this change in policies. And so we have developed what we call faithful disagreement. We recognize that there will always be issues that we do not agree on, but we've put together a paper which provides principles for people to understand that what holds us together is our unity in Jesus Christ. And even though we might disagree on something, our love for one another and our love for the church should be greater than those disagreements. So we're providing very loving support and space for people who are struggling with this issue.
Booth says the Community of Christ clergy members will be allowed to decide for themselves whether they will administer same-sex wedding ceremonies. However, this concession hasn't been enough for some members. A few congregants and even clergy members have already left the church following the decision. Linda Booth says the vote brought tears of sadness from some, but many more have been celebrating what she calls a new understanding within the church.
We, as Community of Christ, are becoming what our name really means, a community that is very welcoming, that all people are welcome around the table.
The Community of Christ will spend the next year determining the details of the new policy. After that, it will be tested for a year before becoming official. For Casey Currents, I'm Alex Smith.
The Kansas City Museum is in its third phase of a major restoration of Corinthian Hall, a northeast Kansas City mansion which was built in 1910 for lumber magnate R.A. Long. And the renovation doesn't stop at just bricks and mortar. A recent project aims to recreate the Georgian garden plantings that surrounded Corinthian Hall. Three full-time caretakers tended the original garden and grounds, and just about all that's left of them are the sunken spaces. The Kansas City Museum enlisted the help of the Westport Garden Club to help discover the plants and methods they would need to make the garden historically accurate. Last June, Susan went to check out the progress.
It's a perfect day to stroll through the gardens of Corinthian Hall. A lush green carpet of grass anchors the sprawling grounds. Stately oaks and maples brush against a cloudless blue sky, and a rotating sprinkler waters patches of new sod and recently planted flowers. I meet Museum Director Christopher Leach here and ask him about turn-of-the-century garden trends.
It was advocated by garden designers at the turn of the century to combine radically different colors, radically different leaf sizes, flower shapes and colors and textures in order to achieve the most robust and dynamic combination of visual experiences that you could provide for your garden visitor. And I think we've accomplished that here at Corinthian Hall. The gardens that were popular at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century were very rich and elaborate and included architectural features and small sculptures, as well as what were called at the time carpet gardens, because they were so densely and elaborately planted that they represented hand-woven oriental carpets. There were a number of such flower beds. We call them parterre gardens today, or on the earth gardens, on the site, including at the north gate and at the south facade, which is the major presentation of our historic site to the street.
Now, does the style of gardening that was used then, which I figured it was kind of an English style, what did it tell you about the people who lived then?
It's a very interesting way to get to know the Long family from the style of gardens. At the time, Kansas City was a robust mix of the refined and the rowdy, and the Long family were certainly on the refined side of life. Their wonderful mansion here, Corinthian Hall, exemplifies the Beaux-Arts architectural style, and the grounds certainly reflect the grandeur of the building that they surround. The beds are well-maintained and well-groomed and carefully cultivated, but they also show a richness and a density and a lushness, and that balance between the naturalistic and the evidence of the man-made was an historic characteristic that exemplified much of what was going on in wealthy America at the time. We have to remember that the Longs' peers nationally were the Carnegies, the Vanderbilts, and the Rockefellers and the Pullmans. So he had good examples of the kind of rich historic environment he was attempting to create in referring to the cottages, as they're known in Newport, Rhode Island, and other large mansions that he visited around the country.
So where are we headed first?
We're headed to the south facade of Corinthian Hall, where we will see installed two elliptical beds that would be the first thing a visitor would see as they're driving along Gladstone Boulevard, approaching the museum from the south. These beds complement some surviving plantings at the south facade, some of which include irises from Longview Farm, which the Long family built and operated until 1971 upon the death of Lula Long Combs. What we see here are two elliptical beds that are 20 feet long and approximately 7.5 feet wide, and they are placed symmetrically on either side of the front walk leading to the front door of Corinthian Hall. We have a wonderful arrangement of canna lilies and castor bean, which were very commonly used in older gardens and will be familiar to any gardener today. Surrounding them in concentric circles, if you think of a badge or a medallion or an oval carpet, since we're talking about carpet beds, are a variety of salvia or sage, which blooms bright purple, pentas, which is a low-growing plant with a bright red flower, and what we have around the edge giving a contrasting border is dusty miller. It appears to be white or very, very light green from a distance, and it helps the bed stand out in contrast. It's like a bright white outline around the oval, lifting it up from the dark green lawn that surrounds it. We placed the castor beans here in the beds on the front because children and other visitors don't have direct access to these beds without supervision. That's important because the castor fruit is deadly poisonous. And while they're very beautiful and we wanted to benefit from the historic reference of having this plant in our garden, we didn't want any of our visitors having that kind of unpleasant experience while they're here at the museum.
So the castor bean has a little spiky red fruit, it looks like.
It looks like a little pincushion or a sea urchin, and there are a number of them on a bright red stem, and the leaves are pointed and shaped sort of like a palm leaf, and they're bright red and purple, and these plants will grow to be between 6 and 8 feet tall.
I see already the butterflies seem to enjoy the garden.
We have quite a number of butterflies who've been visiting us. The real fans of the fresh planting are the robin redbreasts who nest around the site. Whenever we're watering, they come hunting, and they spend a lot of time marching around in between the flowers. We hope they're pulling some weeds while they're in there.
So what was the biggest challenge of this project?
I think that behind the scenes for any garden design and installation project is a lot of research, not just on design and the kinds of plants you want to use. In this instance, we needed to maintain historic accuracy, so there was an added level of research necessary there. And then the examination of the site and where we were going to install, the condition of the soil there, how that needed to be treated and brought up to snuff to sustain intense, dense planting of annuals and some perennials, and then locating examples of the plants that were used historically. Some were very easy to find, such as coleus and petunia and marguerite daisies, because those are very commonly used in gardens today. But there were a couple of others, like the banana trees in the center of our quatrefoil beds on the north side of the estate, that were a little difficult to locate. Finally, we located actually a former staff member of the museum who has, of all things, Japanese mountain banana trees in their garden. And they donated some examples of those for us to include in the quatrefoil beds. Those kinds of exotic plant samples were very common in Gilded Age or Beaux-Arts gardens because they were difficult to come by and they demonstrated the worldliness and the breadth of vision of those who were planting the gardens. So we knew we had to have some tropical examples, and we were very lucky to get those little banana trees for our quatrefoil beds.
Christopher Leach is the director of the Kansas City Museum at Corinthian Hall. To see photos of the historic garden in progress and what it looked like in 1910, go to the KC Currents page of our website.
Susan's story first aired last June. Since then, the Westport Garden Club has conducted more research and is bringing in new annuals like petunias and Joseph coats, as well as a new arch covered with vines. They took out the castor beans because they discovered that's where ricin comes from. Not a good idea. And the banana tree is expected to grow 8 feet tall. Coming up, author Tanner Colby on why it's hard to have friends of a different race in Kansas City. You're listening to KC Currents.
This is KC Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Suzanne Hogan, sitting in for Sylvia Maria Gross. Why do so many white people have no black friends? Is racial integration and equal opportunity for all even possible? Kansas City was one of the places Tanner Colby visited in 2009, looking for answers to those questions. That was for his book, Some of My Best Friends Are Black. What he discovered here was a history of discriminatory real estate practices. According to Colby, J.C. Nichols once enjoyed the dubious distinction of being a national leader in developing and maintaining all-white communities. Susan caught up with Tanner Colby last fall to learn more about how neighborhoods impact relationships and opportunity.
If we've had 40 years of affirmative action and school busing and fair housing and all these different policies, and yet in 2008 I still don't know any black people, then my life would have to be a pretty typical example of what went wrong. And so I went back to look at all the various places in my life, the school that I went to, the neighborhoods I lived in, the places where I'd worked, and not only were they all almost all lily white, they were all pretty textbook examples of the failures of integration. One was my high school in Birmingham, Alabama, which was your typical white flight suburb, much like, you know, Overland Park and a lot of the Kansas Johnson County suburbs, only with the added benefit of our school mascot being the Confederate rebel and our school flag being the Confederate flag. So it was pretty extreme in that way.
So part of this quest, if you will, brought you to Kansas City. Mm-hmm. And you talk in your book about the fact, you point out that Kansas City wasn't always segregated.
Well, what happened was, before the Civil War, there weren't that many free blacks in Kansas City. And then with the economic opportunity that came with the Industrial Revolution and the oppression that enveloped the South with Jim Crow, many blacks did start coming west and stayed in Kansas City, and there was lots of economic opportunity for them there. And in 1900, there wasn't a single black neighborhood that was, you know, majority black. There was nothing you would call the black side of town. There was no east of Troost, west of Troost. People segregated by class, as, you know, will typically happen. And it wasn't until the black presence started getting larger towards the end of the 19-teens that they could be scapegoated the way they were in the South.
You make the point, and I think it's a good point, that there's been very little coverage about the real inside story of real estate and mortgage lending and how that really served to keep the country segregated. And one of the people that you talk about in your book, a Kansas Cityan named Bob Wood, was a major culprit in the Kansas City area in terms of segregating communities. Can you talk some about that?
The civil rights movement, you know, with Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks and the Jim Crow laws that were on the books, those can't be ignored. You know, they have to be reckoned with and acknowledged because it's such a visible part of history. But, you know, real estate sort of buried in the ground. it's been very easy for us to avoid that story and not really reckon with it. And the reality of real estate is what it did in the South. Jim Crow was, you know, a legal apartheid. Blacks and whites in the South lived in relative proximity. There weren't really many big major urban areas in the South, and you had all these small towns, and you know, the white side of town was 2 or 3 minutes from the black part of town. But people kept their distance from each other because law and social custom demanded it. Well, in the North, you didn't have Jim Crow as a legal barrier to keep people separated. So what real estate developer J.C. Nichols did was he and other real estate developers sort of, you know, created this idea of white residential space that could be sold as a premium. And
now,
what that
now,
did...
Why was that so important at that time?
Because it gave segregation a profit motive. It privatized it and turned it into a product that you could buy. And so in the South, losing the right to sit at a lunch counter that was all white had a lot to do with losing social status. And white people didn't want to lose the social status of having, you know, exclusive white spaces and department stores and, you know, and so forth. But to lose the value of your property, because we built up this mythology that all white property was more valuable and that a black person moving into the neighborhood took cash out of your pocket, which was a myth because it was real estate agents like Bob Wood who were destabilizing neighborhoods and destroying property values. But anyway, the point being is that once white people internalized the idea that black neighbors would cost you money, not just a loss in social status, well, then that wall was even higher and more impossible to tear down. Martin Luther King, for all his success in the South, when he went north into Detroit and Chicago and tried to march in white neighborhoods, he just had to turn back. I mean, he was pelted with rocks and you know, he as he said famously, people from the South ought to come to Chicago to learn how to hate. And it was when he touched the third rail of the real estate issue and white people started to think that integration was actual cash money. That was the wall we never got over.
Now, you indicate in your book that, in a way, Kansas City is the birthplace of what you call the segregated American cityscape. If that's true, would you call J.C. Nichols kind of the father of the restrictive covenants that kept neighborhoods white?
Yeah, I call him the Steve Jobs of racism. Because he didn't invent racial covenants. They had existed. Nobody really knows who was the first person to use them or to say you can't sell this house to a black person. Steve Jobs didn't really invent many things either. He appropriated and tinkered with other ideas that existed in the world and, you know, turned them into the Apple or turned them into the iPod. And what J.C. Nichols did was he took this idea of restrictive covenants and he really innovated them. He applied them not just to the house for sale but to the whole subdivision. And then he took the homeowners association and that everyone who lived in that neighborhood was a member of and made that homeowners association legally liable for protecting the whole neighborhood. So therefore, no one member could break the covenant without, you know, violating the contract of living in that neighborhood. And then he also, quite ingeniously, made your voting share in the neighborhood association based on the front footage of your lot, which means that if you had a handful of large property owners could outvote the larger number of owners with smaller lots. And so it was all these innovations that he created that really made the racial covenant ironclad, sought-after product.
There's something in your book that I certainly wasn't aware of, and maybe other people aren't either, that after creating, you know, the Country Club District and Mission Hills here in Kansas City, that J.C. Nichols went on to develop a national real estate organization that then influence similar segregated neighborhoods across the country.
That's one of the things that led me to Kansas City. I grew up in Vestavia Hills, which is sort of like the new money suburb of Birmingham, and then next to it was Mountain Brook, which was very much the Mission Hills of Birmingham. And turns out it was exactly the Mission Hills of Birmingham because the real estate developer from Birmingham was best friends with J.C. Nichols, and they were members of this group together. And when he was founding Mountain Brook in Birmingham, he wrote to to J.C. Nichols and said, hey, can I use your racial covenants? And J.C. Nichols said, more than happy to. And he shared them and sent them on down. And Mountain Brook in Birmingham is a carbon copy of Mission Hills. I mean, there's a you know, Country Club Plaza shopping center just the same as the one in Kansas City, except there's an English Tudor vision village instead of an Andalusian Spanish village. And the same thing happened all over the country. Forest Hills in Queens, New York, Highland Park in Dallas, you know, all these real estate developers. There was basically J.C. Nichols in every major city, and they were all friends. And they all were involved in creating the National Association of Real Estate Boards and creating national real estate board policy. And they were the ones who basically made it part of a realtor's code of ethics nationwide that, you know, introducing unfamiliar ethnic group to an all-white neighborhood is, you know, destabilizing. And it started with J.C. Nichols in Kansas City.
So enter Bob Wood that we've made reference to. Talk a little bit about what he's best known for and some of the tactics that helped the white communities become a place where more and more whites fled.
Well, yeah, as I say in the book, you know, J.C. Nichols built the supply and men like Bob Wood drove the demand. Wood was a blockbuster, as the process became known, which is that you would go to, you know, a block of white houses, and these are over on the east side of Troost, where they weren't protected by the same racial covenants as J.C. Nichols' areas on the west side of Troost. And, you know, they would take a block and pick the weakest homeowner, like the elderly widow who was on a fixed income, and they would just start harassing her and saying, you know, the coloreds are moving in, the blacks are moving in, don't you think you should sell? I'll give you $5,000 for your house today, but if you wait, you'll only get two. And, you know, she'd be terrified. Or what they'd do, if they were particularly creative, a blockbuster would go in and buy a house themselves and then rent it to a black family. But they wouldn't rent it to a working class or middle class black family that, you know, would be the typical type of person to live on that block. They'd go and find recent released prison inmates, black people who fit the worst stereotypes that white people had, and then they would move them onto the block and then start calling all the white neighbors and saying, see, this is the element that's moving into the neighborhood. Don't you think you should get out? And it was all a scam. But the only reason it worked was because the federal government and the National Association of Real Estate Boards had created these all-white havens out in the suburbs because you can only have white flight if you have some place to flee. So the government was building all this new housing stock out in the suburbs, and it was just 1, 2, 3. Real estate developers were creating a selling panic. So the first black family to move in might buy their house for, you know, $15,000 because they were, you know, that desperate to get out of the, you know, the tenements in 18th and Vine. Even though the house was only worth 10, they'd pay 15 for it. Well, then a month later, after having sold off the whole block, the average house value would have been driven down to 2,500. So not only did white families lose most of the value in their homes, but then black families would be left with these underwater mortgages that they'd overpaid for, and they'd default on the house, and then they would just rerun the scam all over again.
And as I understand it, because some of these blockbusters, Bob Wood in particular, they would finance houses themselves, they were having then all kinds of ways to exploit people and reap the benefit.
Right, because what happened was, you know, for years, you had this federal program called redlining, which goes back to the Depression, which is that the federal government basically adopted the same policies as the National Association of Real Estate Board and said that the federal government wouldn't underwrite any mortgage in a mixed neighborhood or in a black neighborhood, and that, you know, all these veterans coming home on the GI Bill, their mortgage payments would be no good in a mixed neighborhood or a black neighborhood. And so all those people ended up going out to the city. And so blacks were denied mortgage credit, you know, because it was only available to whites. And so when they tried to fix this in a rather misguided way, they said, okay, well, it's illegal to deny blacks credit, so the remedy to that is that you were going to make you give any black family credit. Well, the only thing worse than, you know, denying someone credit is giving them too much garbage credit that they can't afford to maintain, which is the exact same thing we saw recently in the subprime mortgage crisis. And so all of a sudden, the federal government had guaranteed that if these scam artists gave black people predatory mortgages and they defaulted on them, then they'd be insured by the federal government. So then it was you could bring any black family in with no down payment, give them an inflated mortgage, and then when they default on it, the federal government would give you a check for, you know, 98% of the value of the mortgage. So these blockbusters like Bob Wood would start buying houses and they just move black families through them, destroying their credit and leaving them with no place to be.
Well, and you know, of course, you talk about the Troost line that everybody's familiar with, where east of Troost is black and west of Troost is white, and where you can't get pizza delivery east of Troost, your insurance rates are higher, your real estate values are lower, and your life expectancy is lower east of Troost. You argue, though, that all of that was created by some of these discriminatory policies that affected housing stock and caused blight.
Mm-hmm. It was more so that, you know, up until, you know, the Brown v. Board decision, the line wasn't as definitive. But before Brown v. Board, the 18th and Vine black neighborhood was kept in place largely by social custom and fear. There had been bombings for any black families that had tried to move out. But two things changed. One was Brown v. Board, which said that you couldn't have racially segregated schools anymore, and the other was just, you know, the rising civil rights consciousness of the, you know, the post-war black community, such that black families were more assertive and more willing to, you know, get out of the tenements, the overcrowded tenements of 18th and Vine, and move out into neighborhoods and face down the threats of white, you know, resistors. And once Brown v. Board outlawed segregated school attendance, then the Kansas City school system shifted from having racially defined school attendance to having neighborhoods defined on or having schools defined by neighborhood attendance. So then you had a system where you had to keep neighborhoods white. Before, you could have one black family move into a mostly white neighborhood and they could still be prevented from attending that school. They'd have to be bused back up to, you know, Lincoln High School or whatever. But after Brown v. Board, you couldn't have a policy like that anymore. So now they had to start shifting real estate barriers so that if a black family moved onto a block, well, then that whole block had to be de-zoned from the white school and rezoned back north towards whatever schools, you know, black majority black schools were in the 18th and Vine area. And what sort of the city father said was, okay, well, we can't avoid this anymore because the Supreme Court's decided it. So we'll just let, you know, if blacks want to move out of 18th and Vine, we'll let the east side go black, because that's where the working class white people are and where we need to really protect the middle class white people over on the west side. And so they just sort of drew a line down Troost and said, and sort of let people like Bob Wood know, you know, if you go out and do this block busting in the working class east side neighborhoods, we're not going to really bother you or come after you. But, if, you know, just stay away from the west side. And that's how the Troost wall became what it is today.
I'm Susan Wilson, and this is Casey Currents. I'm speaking with Tanner Colby, author of Some of My Best Friends Are Black. Now, the one exception that you talk about, or one of the exceptions, is the 4963 neighborhood and its association. And, of course, people locally talk about that as one of the major integration, if you will, successes in Kansas City. Not so fast, you say, though.
Let's put it this way. It's one of the most successful integration experiments in the country. And by which I mean it's marginally successful. It's done many wonderful things, and it's built a foundation that it can continue to grow and become better. But it's by no means a racial utopia. For some people who live there, it is, and some people it isn't. What happened was, you know, when a black family moved into a neighborhood, it became a racially mixed neighborhood, and therefore, you know, it wasn't just blacks getting denied mortgage credit. You could be a white person, and if you wanted to move east of Troost, you'd get your mortgage denied. You know, middle-class white person with good credit, and you can't get a home loan, or your homeowner's insurance triples for no reason just because black families are moving in. And so that really sort of got white homeowners realizing, okay, this affects us too. We've all got, you know, a stake in this. Let's band together to create an integrated neighborhood. And many communities had tried to do that on the east side going back into the 1950s, but none of them really had the toolkit to do it because they were just working class neighborhoods. But when they got to 4963, you had the university there, so you had a lot of university professors with law degrees and economics degrees, and you had the universities themselves, Rockhurst and UMKC, which had a sort of a vested interest in allowing blacks to come in and becoming integrated, but also keeping the stability of the area. So the 4963 group came together and drew a zone from 49 to 63 and from Oak to Paseo and said, let's try an experiment in integration. And from a property rights perspective, from a legal perspective, they did everything right. I mean, it was really just a textbook example of how to create a racially integrated, financially stable neighborhood. They got rid of people like Bob Wood and blockbusters, and they banned yard signs, and they banned these late night solicitations of scaring people, and they really went after any predatory realtors who were breaking the law, and they created incentives for, you know, honest realtors. You know, they created their own home listing service so that realtors who would only conduct legitimate business would be first in line for legitimate home transactions. And they also formed their own mortgage lender called Neighborhood Housing Services, because if the banks were going to deny mortgage credit to blacks or if the banks were going to deny homeowners insurance to even to whites, they would create their own lending institution and, you know, and let people work off their mortgage with sweat equity and really create, you know, a neighborhood. You know, the whole neighborhood's roughly 70% white, 30% black today. And they saved the houses, because before, where you had all these houses being flipped over and turned over and going into foreclosure, then the houses are falling into disrepair. And as you see on the east side of Troost now, whole swaths of neighborhoods are just rotted away and you have to tear them down. So they saved the houses. and protected the houses, and they protected the legal and financial foundation of the neighborhood.
Well, one limitation, yeah, though, was, and that you point out, even though on the surface it's an integrated neighborhood, it's celebrated as such, the ability to form real friendships across the races continued to be limited.
Yes.
Why do you think this was?
You know, you had a number of well-meaning white people who wanted to have an integrated neighborhood, but even as in their good intentions, they couldn't really identify with, you know, the working-class black families that were moving in. You had, you know, college-educated university professors and mostly working-class, you know, black people coming in who were working two and three jobs, you know, and had their own social world that oriented back east to the churches and social clubs of the east side. People, you know, tried to get along. You know, they didn't really have the social toolkit to do it. And you see, you also had still a lot of working class whites who were, you know, of your Archie Bunker type character, who they weren't going to run out to the suburbs, and they, you know, they agreed to live among blacks, but they weren't too thrilled about it. And so, you know, I talked to Alvin Brooks, who was involved in city politics at the time, and he said he'd get a lot of complaints from the neighborhood where, you know, if the, you know, the black family's kids left their toys out on the white neighbor's lawn, the white people wouldn't just go over to the fence and say, hey, can we talk about your kids leaving their toys on our lawn, you know, like neighbors do. You know, they'd call City Hall and, you know, file a complaint because they weren't interested in having a relationship. You know, if your neighbor's with someone and their kid's leaving their toys on your lawn,
you talk to them.
Yeah, you talk to them. But he said, I'd get calls from City Hall for, like, you know, picayune stuff that neighbors should just be solving themselves. And, you know, for the black community's part, they wanted access to a better life for their kids. They wanted access to the better schools and the better neighborhoods, but they didn't really know if they could trust white people. You know, they had a very well-founded suspicion of, are these white people here to actually be friends with us, or is this another blockbusting scam? You know, I did a chapter about church in my hometown of Lafayette, Louisiana, where I lived before I moved to Birmingham. And the priest who oversaw the integration of a church there put it very well. He said that white people's opposition to integration was based on, you know, imaginary stereotypes, black people being criminals, you know, blacks being, you know, lowering property values. And so once they actually encountered honest, decent, good, hardworking black neighbors, a lot of those stereotypes went away. Not all of them, but, you know, the more outrageous imaginary ones were like, oh, well, that was ridiculous. Why did we ever believe that? And so white people just sort of like, okay, well, you know, if I have some black neighbors, again, it's the population critical mass problem. Handful of black neighbors is no big deal. White people eventually got over that pretty quickly. But black opposition to integration is based on very concrete, well-founded reasons, such as, you know, being assaulted for moving into a white neighborhood, or having bricks thrown through your front window, or the, you know, the daily slights of your neighbors not wanting to interact with you or talk to you. And so as blacks moved into places like 4963, they had very good cause to sort of keep people at arm's length and be suspicious of them. But as I said in the book, that was mostly the parents. The kids who grew up in 4963 in the 1970s never knew any different. And that's one of the real lessons I took away from the book, is that integration is not something you do for yourself. It's something you do for your kids. Because, you know, two 40-year-old people who've grown up in different worlds and different cultures, we're not necessarily going to become, you know, best friends overnight. We're just coming from two different places. But we can agree to, you know, respect each other and coexist with each other so that our children will grow up right next door to each other not knowing any different.
Tanner Colby is the author of the book Some of My Best Friends Are Black. We spoke in October. Colby's also written biographies of comedians John Belushi and Chris Farley.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
After the break, local rapper G. Watts gets national airplay in a collaboration with Kendrick Lamar. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Suzanne Hogan in for Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
One for the money, two for my bros, three for the city, now everybody knows.
What's up? No faking. One shot taken. My life was enticed with mayhem, just praying to God I make it.
Many young urban men see rap music as a ticket to a better, more prosperous life. But few ever even get a start in the music industry. 22-year-old G. Watts, however, has a better chance than many. His new mixtape, What's Up, has been featured in Quincy Jones' music magazine, The Source, and other major industry publications and blogs. The track Watts Riot, that's R-I-O-T, features the Kansas City native rhyming with L.A. rapper Kendrick Lamar, a rising hip-hop sensation who made his name on the Internet. Just a few days after the release of G's collaboration with Lamar, the song had more than 16,000 listens. I caught up with G. Watts last week to find out more about how the collaboration happened.
He said my name on Twitter, but he didn't say my name. He was just like, what's up to my G's out there, something. And so I tweeted him, I was like, what you saying my name for? And he was like, huh? And I was like, you trying to do a song? And so, you know, and it grew from that. He was like, DM me. And, you know, ever since we had a cordial relationship with each other.
So when you first reached out to him like that, did you really expect that he was going to take the time to listen to your music?
Because when I reached out to him, he wasn't Kendrick Lamar like he is now. I hit him up probably a week or two before the Dr. Dre co-sign. That's God. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Divine intervention. And so he really wasn't the man that he is, but, you know.
Okay. What kind of influenced
that song?
Yeah, your song, your lyrics.
He came, K-Dot came to Kansas City on tour with Drake. Before he came, he sent me a text like, yo, I think I got one for you for my album. I was like, psh, it's all I needed to hear. And so when he came, played the beat for me, he was in the middle of rapping / writing his verse. He had half of it already recorded, half we were still trying to piece together. And he told me, he was like, hey, man, when I lay this down, I'm going to get it to you. Take it, marinate, live with it, and send it back. I was like, you still writing your verse? He's like, I got about 8 bars. And so as a competitor, I was like, I don't need to take nothing home. I'll write right here with you.
So I want you to paint a picture, because I heard Kendrick's verse was actually recorded on a tour bus. What was that like?
Yeah, it was me, him, his security guard, and my girl, actually. We was on the bus just sitting there watching, and she was like, oh, my God, are you excited? Are you excited? And I was like, girl, it's meant to be. Like, no, I'm not excited. I'm happy and I'm grateful that I'm the one that's able to be in this position. But, nah, this is, you know, divine. So I really don't get hype over stuff like that. I'll be hype when I get 100 million or a billion, something like that. You clowns jiggy rapping, G like it, Biggie happened, this flash with pocket, get it cracking. I take action, no acting, I ain't playing with you. Real whales gave me game, soak like kitty. K-Dot gave me respect, the homie like you crazy blessed. We finna blow like C4 with no bull in that text. Yes, Mike Jack wouldn't make it in this thriller. Watch up, watch everybody get familiar. One for the money, two for my bros, three for the city, now everybody know. So one of the lines, Mike Jack wouldn't make it in this thriller. You were talking about Kansas City? Indeed, yes.
What did you mean by that?
Also in a song I got called Quiet Place, just to tie this all together, I said, my little cousin talking about he killed for a thrill. His big brother, 14, he tripping off a pill. And his big bro getting wet. Imagine how my auntie feel. You know.
And then you say, welcome to my quiet place.
Exactly. You know. So this is all the stuff that I see or have seen growing up here. You know, and I just paint the picture of it, you know, the way that I seen it. And that eventually shows, you know, you wouldn't make it here just as an average person. You got to be strong. You got to be tough.
So how did you come up with your name?
That's my real name. Yes, ma'am.
Is it really?
Yeah.
G-E-E.
Watts. Watts. Oh, named okay. After my daddy.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought it was a stage name.
Nah, no, ma'am. No faking to it.
So what part of Kansas City did you grow up in?
North side, northeast side on 4315 Jackson, 4311 Spruce, which is right down the street from there, 10th and Garfield, 10th and Olive, off of Hardesty and Independence Ave. Mm-hmm. But we've lived in like 13, 14 different houses. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've been everywhere scattered throughout, but mainly, you know, the north and the east part.
So what was growing up in Kansas City like for you? Real talk.
For me, you know, growing up as a kid, I had a lot of people that would use me because I had both of my parents in the house, and so I was privileged a little bit. I'd get, you know, I had a basketball goal outside our crib, and so people would come over and we'd play ball and stuff like that. But other than that, if they wasn't trying to hoop, they wasn't trying to rock with me. But that was because, you know, I was a bad little spoiled brat, you know what I'm saying, considering what I was growing up in. And then whenever I moved schools out of the inner city, I said in premature hate, actually, talk about when my mama told me to take a knife to school or whatever, and then I got kicked out of my elementary. I went to Fairview Alternative after that. And then being in there, my mom and daddy was like, man, this is just stifling you, because my work was like in a packet. We really didn't have like real work. We just had a packet, and you go through the packet, you good. So it's like, hell nah, excuse me. I was like, nah, you know what I'm saying? You need to do some real work. Mm-hmm. And so my mama is actually from the Kansas side. Her whole family stay in Kansas. And I ended up going to school in Kansas. And being there, I got to see that side of life. And I got to realize I ain't ish. You know what I'm saying? My little gifts that my mama and daddy throw to me ain't nothing compared to, you know, how some other kids got it. And that humbled me fast, you know. And so then I started being able to have more friends and stuff like that. But growing up, I just had my cousins, you know what I'm saying? And I rock like that. Really couldn't trust too many.
Now, you lost a good friend at a young age. What impact did that have on you?
Not to speak negatively, but when that happens at such a young age, all it do is make you numb to it. At least for me, definitely. When I seen him laid in the middle of the street as a 9-year-old kid, me and him being like 14 at the time, you think that that's common and that's normal. So then whenever it do end up happening again, you know, it's like kind of second nature. In the past month, I've lost 3 cousins and a homeboy, you know, and so
gun violence.
Two was gun violence, one was a car crash, and the other was a suicide. So
I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
So I know in your music, and we'll talk more about your music later, that you talk about the fact that Kansas City can be a rough place, though, to grow up.
Mm-hmm. It can, if you you know, if you allow it to be, you allow it. You got a whole bunch of people just trying to raise they self, and the game that they getting is through some fairy tale rap music, or you know, fictional movies, or fake gangsters in TV, you know what I'm saying? And that ends up just bringing out the worst in everything and everybody, you know? Mm-hmm. So when you grow up amongst that and you have that as your blueprint, what you gonna get? You know what I'm saying? It's easy to be enticed if you don't surround yourself by the right folks. Of course, you know, all my homeboys were growing up in the same part of town that I grew up in. So not only are they from the same city, but for the most part, they're from the same spot. And watching them, because I'm the youngest one out of all my homies, watching all them strive for better. They got 9-to-5s. You know what I'm saying? Most of them don't smoke. A few of them do, but most of them don't. So it's easy for me to take the good out of each one of them and try to implement it in my life, thank God, because I got older homies who know game and they give me game. You know what I'm saying?
So at what point did you start getting interested in writing rhyme and rapping?
When I was like 2 years old, I actually used to go down. It's a park. It's still there, but it used to jump a little bit more back in the day. I would rap. My pops would pull out a little suitcase, and I'd stand on the suitcase, and I'd perform, and they'd give me like, you know, $1 here, $2 there. But, you know, so it's been in me since a youngin'. But I started writing, I want to say 8th grade, and when I heard T.I.'s Urban Legend and Kanye Late Registration.
I have to tell you that when I listened to Trust Nobody, I felt really kind of sad, because I started thinking about what kind of world would it be if you couldn't trust anybody.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I don't trust these at all. I don't trust
Easy to lose, but it's hard to earn. I don't play round with these clowns, keep my stance firm. To all you lame, just rocking the same clothes, then post a cute pic on Twitter and thanking you that thing. No! To
all the How have your experiences led you to that place?
Well, to this point, I feel like you can't trust nobody 100%, period. Maybe that's wrong, maybe it's right. I feel like you should love all, trust few, you know what I'm saying? You should love most, you know what I'm saying, and trust none 100%.
So you want to do a little rhyme while you're in the studio?
Yeah, I think I'll do that for you.
All right, go on right ahead. What are we going to hear?
I just wrote this, so, and it's the one that I know by heart right now. Staring at these brick walls where I'm having a withdrawal. What direction I'm headed, I'm begging to take the chip off my shoulder. Can't hold them, them grudges cause a quick fall. Get clipped if you cross the wrong bro. Pray Chris Paul will be the one. Froze cold when he squeezed a gun. Barrel on my liver, I quiver knowing this day will come. Native tongue of young killers trying to suffice it with drum drillers. Sherm stick motors fold none quicker. Killing they self, dying of thirst, needing some help. Talent on shelf, belief nowhere to be felt. See, prideful's what I'm not. Pride won't find the belt. Aiming to get the title before my rival come and melt. The skin I'm in with Mac 10 tears. Crying out for help. Pellets penetrating my peers. 2K12. Goddamn, one hell of a year. 13 started off worse. I knew my blessing was near. Fear, can't have none. Strengthen your spleen. At 9, I saw a big homie fall at 14. His body lay lifeless. His blood covered his jeans. Tim's on his feet. Bumblebee tape marking the scene. Still to this very day, I hear his mama scream. Growing up this away, imagine the drama it brings. Trying past that, trying to resonate while I earn every opportunity before I burn. A lot of rappers talk that talk, so I smooth watch. Giving game out like 50 Iveens inside the dock. Again, talk that talk, Huey on Boondock. Ill Will got it right, I'm Huey on that rooftop. Yes, ma'am.
All right. Yeah, I like that flow.
Thank you. And you didn't even hear the beat. Imagine when you hear the beat with it. Ooh,
it's gonna be nasty.
Oh, you know it, you know it.
So what's next for G Watts?
I'm coming out with a video to Nasty. Yes, she dancing. come out with a video to Nasty. And also just try to push this mixtape as much as possible, because I feel like the music, like I said, resonate. It's a decent body of work. And so therefore, I want it to be heard on a level it deserves to be heard at, not just a local level and a few folks outside of this scene hearing it. I want everybody to be able to hear it as much as possible, you know. So once that's done, then we'll start talking about new music. But until then, we're just going to push this.
G, thank you for joining us in the KCUR studios.
Thank you for having me.
Kansas City rapper G Watts has a new mixtape out called What's Up and a video called A Quiet Place.
Young and handle business and thank it. No, might hug him and kiss him, might flip him in. Why? That there be my ticket and my claim to show you difference. Yeah. D be tricking, but on me she pay attention. I really, really get it in my heyday, I was gritting. 16 BMW hit the club inches. Boy, I was so icy, they ain't like me, I'm no different. I ain't like them because I grind for mines. My OGs ain't get this.
We really appreciate you tuning in to KC Currents. Check out anything you might have missed or you want to hear again on our webpage at kcur.org.
Or find us on iTunes. You can reach us at KCCurrents at KCUR.org or on Twitter at KCCurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Sylvia Maria Gross with associate producer Alex Smith. Our intern is Monica Sandretsky, and our theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Suzanne Hogan. Sylvia Maria Gross returns next week.